Hi there and welcome. You're listening to the GIST podcast number 12. My name is Josh Marsh, and this is a particularly special episode as it's the first in what we hope will be a long series of joint episodes with Glasgow Uni's Naturally Speaking podcast. James Bergen, would you tell us a bit about the podcast and introduce yourself?
Hi Josh, I'm glad to be here. Naturally Speaking was set up to discuss science within the remit of the Institute of Biodiversity, Animal Health and Comparative Medicine, which covers everything from ecology and conservation to evolutionary biology, epidemiology and veterinary medicine. Our podcasts tend to take a more relaxed conversational approach, and we've discussed everything from the science behind movies like Jurassic Park and Jaws to more practical advice, like our last podcast, explaining how academics can engage with social media.
We caught wind of Naturally Speaking earlier in the semester and thought it would be a great opportunity to collaborate on some podcasts in the fields that they cover. Pooled effort equals better science.
Today I thought we could explore the fascinating world of wildlife disease monitoring, a big theme in my institute.
We figured this would be a particularly appropriate topic given the recent media coverage of the badger cull in England, which attempted to control the spread of tuberculosis in cattle.
But today I thought we could go for a more international take. On the 2nd of February, the Institute of Biodiversity, Animal Health and Comparative Medicine played host to Professor Ted Layton. Professor Layton is an incredibly accomplished veterinary pathologist at the University of Saskatchewan in Canada. He was instrumental in setting up the Canadian Wildlife Health Cooperative and was actually the executive director until recently. But he's also been involved in a number of international projects, all focused on wildlife disease.
In the late 1970s and early 1980s, Canada was on the rising curve of infectious disease in its wildlife. TB, brucellosis, anthrax, chronic wasting disease, rabies, plague, Newcastle's disease, and as Professor Layton described it, a bunch of weird fish diseases. These are just some of the many pathogenic agents afflicting Canada's wildlife.
As wildlife managers started to notice anomalous outbreaks and awareness grew, the idea for the Canadian Wildlife Health Cooperative was formed. But what exactly is it? Professor Layton explains.
So this is a partnership among Canada's now five veterinary colleges as sort of the principal group that makes this program happen. But we do it on behalf of the federal and the provincial wildlife, public health, and agriculture veterinary agencies, animal health agencies of the country. So we're kind of one program that serves all, and it's a little bit different in that we have no authority, but we work under the authority of government agencies, and they essentially look to us to provide both the ideas and the actual on-the-ground work of this program. So in one way, we're a service center so that government agencies can do diligence in an area where they themselves don't have much expertise, or if they have some expertise, they need backup. And this carries right through to Canada's representation at the international level. And then on the other hand, we're sort of an academic wildlife health sciences center, which we're expected to provide academic program and teaching and graduate student projects and research and that kind of stuff.
The cooperative has two main roles. Its core program is, unsurprisingly, wildlife disease surveillance, finding out what diseases Canada has in what animals and where. This can feed back into land management and policy decisions and goes hand in hand with educational outreach programs. Why might you be interested in wildlife disease surveillance? Professor Layton gives us some examples of the impact the cooperative has had.
It turns out this, some of what we do has a lot of utility for food safety. Sometimes at the community level, we're part of a program of trichinella testing at a community level, for example, that's been quite effective in mitigating human trichinellosis. Some of the stuff we've done has actually made a difference in trade. We've had trading partners who are convinced Canada knows what it's doing with respect to things like avian influenza and don't close their markets when because they say, oh, you know what you have in wildlife. You say you don't have this bad one, you don't, you know, that kind of thing. So that's been handy for our federal veterinary services. And we do have some input in animal health policy. We're not a policy-setting organization, but I guess we've become sufficiently important to the agencies, particularly federal agencies we serve, that we're usually asked to be at the table when policy issues that are associated with wildlife come up.
While trade and policy are important social needs, what about human and animal health? Has setting up the cooperative helped save lives?
Human lives saved. Have we really done that? But we probably have. You know, if you look at kind of the public health applications of the various things that we've done and the educational programs that not necessarily that we have done ourselves but have come out of the information we've helped generate, I think we've made substantial gains in things like trichinella and type E botulism in the north and a few things like that. West Nile virus control, avian influenza, we never really were at risk, I think, from that. Things like that, I think we made a difference. Are our wildlife healthier? Well, at least we know a lot more about the things that make them unhealthy. And I think we're in a position more quickly to jump on issues and try to do something about it. White nose syndrome in bats is a good example of something that just arrived in Canada fairly, arrived in North America in 2006-2007, has made some of the most abundant mammal species in North America almost extinct in just a few years, but one in which actually, because we have this infrastructure, we've been able to look for it immediately, find it probably very early, and at least track it and be prepared to do whatever science comes along and tells us we might be able to do, because we kind of know where it is and how it's moving and the kind of risks we have in its potential westward moving path. So I think we have made some conservation gains along those lines.
A lot of focused research projects have emerged around trying to figure out what animals die from and what pathogens they're carrying at that time. And this is the second role of the Canadian Wildlife Health Cooperative.
A lot of research projects arise out of this. The primary finding is in the surveillance program, but then it goes off, you know, how does chronic wasting disease work in the prairies? We've got a lot of work on the animal welfare side of wildlife harvest, wildlife research, and wildlife management, trying to find new ways of non-invasive sampling and things that get the same kind of information that invasive would. Is the seal hunt a bad thing from the animal welfare point of view? That kind of stuff.
These secondary projects, which spin out from the surveillance, provide a wealth of material for student projects. Apparently so much so that it's hard to keep track of it all.
It's hard to count sometimes, but at any one time there's about 50 graduate students in Canada whose program depends in one way or another on this program, either from the supervision by paid personnel or because they get their research material out of what we're doing or they're using our database or whatever it is.
It is clear that maintaining this cooperative is a lot of work. However, the results are more than worth the effort. But how does the process of disease surveillance in wildlife even work? After all, these are wild animals. When humans get sick, we go to the doctors, and when domestic animals get sick, we call a vet. This allows us to easily accumulate data as the individuals report themselves for treatment. Wild animals do not self-report, and so collecting data takes a bit of effort.
And in wildlife, this is the way I sort of, this is the way I look at surveillance in general, but so we have, you got to find sick and dead wild animals. This is all basically on autopsy and further diagnostic work. So it's why, what did the animal die from or with, as completely as we can figure it out. And you have to keep collecting, have to keep looking, because things change with time. And it takes about 20 years to accumulate enough qualitative data to start having what might be considered quantitative data, or at least data that has broad implications across space and time, and it gives a reasonably complete view of what pathogens are in what hosts and what regions and that kind of thing.
In order for a program like this to work effectively, you require a large network of people. That includes people in the field, monitoring and finding sick animals, pathologists to perform autopsies, lab workers to identify microbial pathogens, and informaticians to maintain the Canadian Wildlife Health Cooperative's database, which currently contains over 250,000 records. Then you need analysts to make the data informative and people to disseminate the gathered information to interested bodies, everything from public health agencies to conservation charities.
Maintaining a network like this is a constant task, as disease prevalence, procedures, and policy decisions change all the time. It takes constant monitoring and hard work, and this leads to a question everyone is itching to ask.
Everyone wants to know how much this kind of thing costs. It varies, but we go from 3.3 million a year is about what. So it's dirt cheap, really, when you think about the size of Canada. Five institutions covering the ground for about 22 government organizations, all of whom share in that cost rather than pay for their own programs.
This novel approach, combining university and government agency resources into a single unified program, has kept costs low and the output high. But what does Professor Layton think is the most valuable aspect?
I think in some ways the model is almost worth more than the organization in some ways, because I think it's in the right country, it's a really good way to do stuff. And it puts academia at the center, providing academia is willing to behave itself and respect communication needs and the authority that government agencies actually have and work under that authority and that kind of thing. So it's been a really good partnership. And I think it's meant that Canada has a program that would otherwise cost Canada roughly $20 million for about four.
This model has proven to be more viable than anyone involved in its formation could have imagined, and it has influenced Professor Layton to shift his focus slightly in recent years, from Canada to the more exotic shores of Sri Lanka.
Sri Lanka is an island nation located to the southeast of India. It's just smaller than Scotland and boasts a massive human population of over 20 million individuals. Long considered a jewel in the Indian Ocean, it was cast into turmoil in 1983 at the outbreak of a civil war, which lasted until 2009. Since then, Sri Lanka has been playing catch-up in terms of social and economic infrastructure.
So, where does the wildlife part come in? In addition to its massive human population, Sri Lanka also has a remarkable assemblage of animal life.
The wildlife in Sri Lanka is just incredible, and there's wild animals everywhere. And they live in and amongst people in a major way. And the national parks, you know, you get in the jeep, you go through them, you will see 50 to 500 elephants. You will see buffalo and deer, and like you wouldn't believe. You might not see a leopard so easily, but they're there.
Many animals native to Sri Lanka can act as potential reservoirs for disease. For instance, the presence of wild, feral, and domestic buffalo provides a route for disease to get into farming. Perhaps more sinister is the potential for zoonotic diseases. This is where a pathogen jumps from an animal into a human, and it's not uncommon. Rabies, bird flu, and HIV are all examples.
Two factors increase the potential for zoonotic transfer: disease prevalence and contact. And here is where the Sri Lankan combination of lots of people, lots of wildlife, and not much space could become an issue. Human-wildlife interactions are part of daily life on the island, and natural habitats are becoming increasingly fragmented. This is bad, because disease likes disturbance.
In perturbed environments, epidemics seem to become more and more common. You know, there's something about a lot of disease organisms that seem to be kind of like weeds. They really do well in a highly disturbed environment, and it changes patterns of disease.
While Sri Lankans are aware of some diseases in domestic livestock, they lack any broad wildlife screening procedures. In the wake of the Civil War, few people were thinking about wildlife disease, and they lacked any kind of infrastructure needed to start.
There's only one pathologist, veterinary pathologist, in Sri Lanka. So you can imagine what role pathology has in animal disease diagnosis in the place. None, right? But that means they almost don't know what they have outside of a few domestic animal diseases.
In an effort to change this, one minister took an unorthodox but highly effective approach.
But in 2005, an assistant deputy minister from the Department of Agriculture landed in Toronto and heard there was a vet school not far away and went out and knocked on the dean's door and said, "We need help." And the dean didn't know what to do. But eventually, this trickled down to a group called the Center for Coastal Health, which is a little NGO, nonprofit research organization focused on kind of looking at health as an ecological construct. And the director of that said, "Okay, I'll invest in a trip to Sri Lanka to see if there's anything we could do for you."
That act led to the awarding of $1.3 million to develop a 5-year program to build veterinary capacity in Sri Lanka, with a focus on public health. From this came a wide recognition that Sri Lanka was in need of much greater capacity in wildlife disease monitoring, and the Canadian Wildlife Health Cooperative was happy to lend aid.
We helped them come up with a plan. And what they did is they used our organization as a model. And it's hard to, you can't really overemphasize what a key achievement this is for a country. They got three ministries, or three departments, domestic animal health, public health, and wildlife conservation, and the only veterinary college in the country, to agree that they would form this thing called the Sri Lanka Wildlife Health Center, that it would not belong to any one of them. They would actually govern it together. At this point, no one was talking about money. They were just talking about a framework whereby they might do things together. And, you know, it took about 18 months of negotiation to make this happen, but in the end, they signed it.
The Canadian Wildlife Health Cooperative is helping this new Sri Lankan Wildlife Health Center on a 4-year development program, mainly focused around education. They are training several graduate students, half focused on the biological sciences, half focused on the social sciences. By combining these two fields, they build capacity in wildlife disease surveillance, while at the same time making sure the impacts and needs of local communities are fully understood.
Perhaps one of the most important aspects of the Canadian Wildlife Health Cooperative's involvement is the training of two new veterinary pathologists who are instrumental in understanding what an animal has or died from. This is especially significant given the lack of developed procedures and infrastructure in Sri Lanka. Professor Layton told us about an autopsy teaching experience he had, where he was staring at a table with two dead gray langur monkeys on it, and nothing but a pair of latex gloves and an apron to protect him.
I wouldn't be able to do this except at a simulated level 3, you know, in a biological safety cabinet, you know, mask, you know, a whole bit. because it's an old world monkey and we have no idea what they have, but we're pretty closely related to them, so whatever they have, we might get. And maybe they'll have herpes B, but probably not with gray langurs. But anyway, so but this was a good teaching moment, right? Because what do you do? Well, either you just throw them away or you do something as safely as you can, which we opted for. But this is the modern age, right? So we Googled a few things. About how, you know, what do we know about herpes B, right? Turns out not very much, and it's all in macaques, and it's all in captive settings of one sort or another, mostly breeding colonies. So, you know, probably our risk is pretty low. But, you want to die, you're going to do this safely. You know, it's a good teaching moment.
The road ahead for Sri Lanka is long. Right now, they're at a very early stage in capacity building, and it will take years of hard work, investment, and cooperation in order to develop a program even close to the Canadian Wildlife Health Cooperative. Luckily, people like Professor Layton will be there to help. But maybe by doing so, they can learn some lessons for the West. Historically, Western nations have taken a rather cavalier approach to life. If they needed samples or needed to control wildlife disease, the logical move was to use a gun. However, in the predominantly Buddhist and Hindu nation of Sri Lanka, this simply isn't an option.
Culturally, it's a completely different landscape. Not so much politically, but culturally. Because, for example, killing an animal is just simply unacceptable. So, you know, imagine our Western way of going about getting samples and figuring things out when you have your highly abundant species going bang, bang, bang. Just doesn't seem like anything but common sense. Whereas there, it's not possible. So that imposes quite a different set of constraints and approaches to this kind of work, and to the kinds of management options. But it's quite interesting because if you say no, you know, killing off a bunch of animals isn't a management option, you have to think in a different way than we tend to in the Western world. The Western world is actually changing its opinions on this also now quite radically. But in the past, you know, more or less what can we kill has been the question of managing disease and wildlife. And so that's just off limits. The other thing that's very culturally very interesting is how tolerant the people of Sri Lanka are of their wildlife. They view nature as part of their surrounding. It's kind of like bad weather. If an elephant comes in and takes out your plantation of bananas, that's not a reason to go out and shoot the elephants. Right? It's a problem. I don't quite know what to do about it, but it's not one that has that kind of solution. And it's just a very different way of looking at things.
Perhaps in helping to build a wildlife disease surveillance program under this different moral perspective, Professor Layton and his colleagues will find a new, more ethical approach for the West. One in which animal life is treated with a little bit more regard, or, if you will, as a little bit more sacred.
Thanks for joining us. As always, if you have any questions or want to get involved with the podcast, you can email us at podcasts@the-gist.org. That's podcasts at the-gist.org. And James, how can they get in touch with Naturally Speaking?
Oh, we actually have a thing for that.
Thanks for listening to the Naturally Speaking podcast. If you've got any ideas for future shows or want to get involved, then please contact us. We'd love to hear from you. Our email address is naturallyspeakingpodcast@gmail.com. Naturally Speaking is a podcast from the Institute of Biodiversity, Animal Health and Comparative Medicine at the University of Glasgow. For more information, you can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter at the NS Podcast. And you can download future episodes and find more information at our blog at naturallyspeakingpodcast.wordpress.com.
This has been The Gist with Naturally Speaking. Tune in next time.
When you were speaking before, when I set up, it was okay. But when you start actually speaking into mic, you're way much louder.
Am I louder or is he quiet?
I don't know.
Reading is hard.
Reading is surprisingly hard.